Good morning, everyone. Greetings in Jesus' name from Tylertown, Mississippi. I think Brother Keith asked me to share at these meetings a few times over the past number of years, and it occurred to me that if I had agreed sooner, I may have escaped these assignments. But so it goes, and here we are. The planning committee gave me a brief summary of each title, and I tried to condense those summaries even farther into questions that should be answered. And so today, with the earth worship subject, I think there's two questions that need to be answered. And the first one is, how do Christians live responsibly in a neo-pagan earth worship culture without worshiping the earth? So that's question one. And question two that was in the summary was, how do we, or what are the moral boundaries in the biotech advancements such as GMOs, mRNAs, virtual reality, Neuralink, and I put things like artificial intelligence in there as well. And the thing about this is that that's supposed to somehow be accomplished in 35 to 45 minutes. So, having said all of that, I am going to knowingly paint with a very wide brush, and there's going to be details that are not, it's not possible to cover. So just know that. And I don't see a clock. So if I'm running over time, which is entirely possible, somebody up here on the front row, just, you know, let me know, because I do sense that's a real possibility. Let's go into this. To start with, I'd like to give you a few definitions of words that we might be using throughout the day, not just in this message, but in other ones. First of all, the word paganism. What exactly are we talking about when we talk about something being pagan? What's it about? Well, it's usually, in ancient cultures, it would involve the worship of nature, usually polytheistic, meaning many gods. And usually when we think of the word pagan, we are referring to what I think we would consider a pre-Christian era, a pre-Christian world, before Jesus was sent to the world and then was killed and resurrected. A term that has come to be used is neo-paganism. What is that? Well, when you put the prefix neo in front of a word, it just means that it's the new form of that. So you may have heard of something like neo-Nazism. Well, that just means that it's the modern version of Hitler's Nazism. So when we talk about neo-paganism, we're talking about a new form of ancient paganism, which means that the worship of nature is being revived in some way. And usually when we think of something being neo-pagan, it's post-Christian. I don't know if y'all are familiar with that term, but it's certainly one that is used, that we live in a post-Christian world. In other words, the atmosphere of the mind of the culture we live in is not taking Christianity as a presupposed premise. The third thing that we will use just particular in this message is a term, climate alarmism. It's a negative term. It's a negative bias. When you use a word like alarmism, you're not, like, I automatically have given you a little bit of information about what I think about climate change. And so I'm going to just use that term. It's a negative bias term to describe people who believe that there will be some catastrophic outcome to the current climate changes unless we humans take drastic measures. I already used this word. I'll give you a definition. Biotech or biotechnology, what are we talking about? It's the use of biological systems, organisms, or their components to develop products or technologies for specific practical purposes, especially in medicine, agriculture, and industry. The word worship, we've been talking about that off and on here this morning in the devotion and in the comments Brother Keith made. What is worship anyway? This is a word that probably should just have a whole message. So there you go for one of you preachers. Talk about what worship actually is. I believe it comes from an old word based on two words, worth-ship, something like that. And it's actually a little hard to define, because worship is manifested in actions, and the actions can become somewhat confused with worship itself. So an act of worship could be things like prayer or singing or something like that, meditating perhaps. But does that mean that when you engage in singing that you are worshiping? Well, not necessarily. And so it's very somewhat difficult to grab a hold of. It's a little bit like humility. If you think you're humble, then you probably aren't. So what is humility anyway? Well, it's a little bit like that. Jesus teaches us that the worship of the Father is done in spirit and in truth, and there's a transcendent element to worship, meaning that the spirit of the person is drawn toward what he or she is worshiping. And that takes me to another word, and that's the word idolatry. We can probably just call it false worship, but what do we mean by false worship? Well, if it's true, if the statement I just made is true, that worship can be defined or it can be understood in the way that whatever you're drawn toward is proof of what you worship, then idolatry is very dangerous, because if you're drawn to what you worship, if you're worshiping a false god, you're going to end up in places you don't want to be. And we can see idolatry all around us. We don't perhaps in Western culture have the idolatry of literally kissing an idol or something of that sort. But I would submit to you that here in this area, especially with your state college football, you can watch idolatry happen over the football games. It's very simple. There's people that's what their life revolves around. I've distilled idolatry for my own satisfaction in the definition I'll share with you now. An idol is what we turn to for answers to life's problems. I believe that pretty much just takes care of it, for me anyway. If you need more than that, certainly feel free to flesh it out for yourself. But it makes sense to me when I'm in trouble, what's my first impulse? Where do I go to find answers? If it's Google, then I'm worshiping technology. If it's God, then, well, hopefully that's where it goes. Finally, in definitions, a steward. What are we talking about with stewards? Well, a steward is a person who's entrusted with the care, supervision, or management of something that does not belong to them, such as property, resources, people, or duties. So those are some definitions. Let's get into the questions. How do Christians avoid neo-paganism of earth worship while being responsible stewards of the earth and its resources? I don't think that I'm talking to a group of people that would be tempted with the manifestations of earth worship that come from what we call tree huggers, or there's extreme versions of earth worship in Wicca and things like that, like the modern witchcraft sort of things. I don't think I'm talking to people that would be tempted with that. So I think for this particular question, it would be more helpful to think about what stewards are supposed to be doing and how we're supposed to think, rather than how to avoid not being pagan. So a couple of verses. If you don't want to turn to these, it might be a little hard to keep up. I'm going to move rather quickly. But in Psalm 24, we have one poetic statement that describes the Bible belief, or the Bible, belief of what is going on with the earth. And that is, the earth is the Lord's, and the fullness thereof, the world and they that dwell therein. That's something we should remember as Christians. The earth is the Lord's. That seems so basic. It's something you've probably heard since you can remember, most likely, if you were raised in a Christian home. Why then is it difficult to remember this? Why is it hard to think of the earth as being the Lord's? Well, in Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 through 31, Genesis 2, verses 15 and 20, God commissions mankind to take care of the earth. And I found a verse in Psalms a couple years ago that I don't know why, but you know how it is when you find a verse that you just really like, you just can't get away from it. So if you've heard me talk about this verse before, bear with me. But in Psalm 15, verse 16. The psalmist writes, "The heaven, even the heavens, are the Lord's, but the earth hath he given to the children of men." Now, I know psalms are poetry. I get that. But I think there's a truth here that goes back to the principle in Genesis of God commissioning man to take care of the earth. The earth hath he given to the children of men. So God has graciously given us the realm of the earth to take care of. Now, wise people, Christian people, will recognize that they are stewards, that they have a job to do to take care of it according to God's way of wanting it to be taken care of. Evil people, selfish people, misguided Christians think that, well, God gave it to us so we can do with it whatever we want. And that's where we get into trouble. That's where we end up in strange lands, because people do things with unintended consequences, and, well, then we try to undo that with more man-made solutions. So I think it can be somewhat difficult sometimes to remember that we are here as agents of a good God. And that takes me to another principle. Creation does have value. Genesis is full of the story, or not full, but the first chapter is full of the story of God creating. And every time he creates, we finish up, God saw that it was good. And when he puts man on the planet, God saw that it was very good. So we have this good creation. As stewards, another principle we need to remember is that we seek to live unselfishly. I'm not exactly sure where this point fits, because it seems like I might jump back and forth a little bit. But it's important to remember, in the context of God giving us the earth's wealth and resources, that we use it carefully. And it occurs to me that that may be the main problem with the rich fool in Luke chapter 12. Luke 12, verses 16 through 21, "The ground of a certain rich man brought forth plentifully. And he thought within himself, saying, 'What shall I do? Because I have no room where to bestow my fruits.' And he said, 'This will I do. I will pull down my barns and build greater, and there will I bestow all my fruits and my goods, and say to my soul, Soul, thou hast much goods laid up for many years. Take thine ease, eat, drink, and be merry.' But God said unto him, 'Thou fool, this night thy soul shall be required of thee. Then whose shall those things be which thou hast provided? So is he that layeth up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God.'" So there's a lot going on in that parable, but it is clear that God does not really intend for people to get so wealthy and selfish that they can just hoard everything and stop working and not care about anybody else. Like, that's pretty clear that that's at least one level of things that Jesus wants us to take from that. And I'm going to extend that just a little bit, that our job, when we have the abundance of the earth given to us, our job is not to just hoard that, but to then, especially as Christians, represent the generosity of God by giving it back to people in need, people that are not as perhaps fortunate in earthly goods as we are. What if this man would have done that? There's no telling. Well, another point, another principle about Christians avoiding neo-paganism. I'm going to try to explain this, but I'm a little nervous about this point because it's got too much political baggage with it. But as stewards, I believe we should seek to live sustainably. Now, let me unpack that, because this is a buzzword that everything should be sustainable, and so you should stop mining coal, and, you know, everything should be sustainable, so you should never cut down a tree. All right. Especially in agriculture, and I think with us, most of us have a strong agricultural background, and this sustainability argument has hit this sector really, really hard, and I think we have collectively become reactionary because of that. So clearly in the world, in the pagan mindset, there is a religion made of sustainability. I'm not going to deny that at all. But it's really foolish of us to believe that we can do things against wisdom and against sustainability and think that somehow that represents God. Like, I think somehow we need to be wise in this thing. And the Christian goal for sustainability is not because we think that somehow we are responsible for the salvation and redemption of the world. That's not why we do it. It's because we believe God made it, and it's good, and we're responsible to take care of it, and we will give account to him for what we have done with it. I think that's the motive that gives Christians a basis for sustainability. It's not because, well, if we mess this earth up, then Mars is our only option. It's not where we are at all. But because of that belief, I'm afraid we've reacted a little bit. So hopefully we've navigated that one safely. The last thing, I would like to just finish with a few principles, just kind of hit them quickly here. We can avoid pagan earth worship when, number one, we recognize and affirm the earth as a creation. It is not a divine entity. Earth worshipers use phrases like Mother Nature and things like that, where it's almost as if the earth is somehow alive in the sense that it has a spirit or something. I do not believe that. Romans 1:25, though, does teach us that the earth is created, and it's not a divine entity to be worshipped. There's a big difference there. Romans 8:22, for number two, we can avoid pagan earth worship when we recognize and affirm that the creation as we know it is under a curse. Romans 8:22 talks about the whole creation groaning and travailing. The Christian hope is that there will be a redemption of the creation as we know it. And so while we seek to live carefully and responsibly and wisely in this world, we also recognize that it's under a curse because of man's sin. And we'll talk about some of that maybe a little later. I'm not sure how that'll all work out. The third thing, recognize and affirm that while it is under that curse, the earth is still good and needs to be cared for. And I just went for a principle for that in Exodus, where God told his people the way they're supposed to let their land have a rest every couple of years. And there's really something to be said for that, if we want to take good care of ourselves and the earth and so on. We even though it's under a curse, we still take care of it. We don't just make the curse worse. And the fourth way that I think, or at least, that I have listed, is that we can recognize and affirm that greed and selfishness is just as pagan as paganism. Ezekiel 16:49 and 50 is a study on the sin of Sodom. It wasn't just homosexuality. It wasn't just inhospitality. It was the fact that they hoarded things. They were proud. They were selfish. They were greedy. And they didn't care about anybody except themselves. And that is pagan. And God judged them for that. And so if we fall into those kinds of ways of living, first of all, we're not being good stewards. And second, we're pagan. So let's just think about that. All right. The next big question for this morning is the moral bounds of biotech relating to modifying the genes of plants, animals, and even people. I spent a considerable amount of time trying to tie the Mother Earth tree hugger to Elon Musk's Neuralink, because that seemed to be what the planning committee wanted me to do. But I don't think you can do that, to be honest, because it seems to me that they're actually, I think they're maybe sides of the same coin, maybe. But the previous group of Save the Earth, back to the original sustainable types, their idol is the Earth. Their belief is that the problems are that humans get in the way of nature, and that somehow if we can get back to the right rhythms and cycles, and if we plant our seeds a certain direction under a certain sign of the moon, then we will always have fertile crops. And if you don't do that, then you're in bad trouble and you're a bad person and you should be killed. Just get out of here because you're not working with nature. And Earth can't sustain more than so many people and so on. That particular group, I think, finds their solutions and their salvation in something different than the group that says, let's put a chip in your brain. Because the tech utopia type of nature worship seems to say in its constitution that nature has the answer to all of our problems, but we must get them from her. We must unlock all of her codes and mysteries, and then we will be able to completely have dominion and completely subdue nature to the point that we can then live forever. It's the same thing, but a totally different way of getting there. So I don't really think the one leads to the other necessarily. I don't think you can, I think it's somewhat divergent paths trying to achieve salvation in a way apart from Christ and so on. And so there's a group of people that are thinkers out there that think that you can, that the human beings, given enough time and enough energy and enough money and technology, we can transcend nature in such a way that we will no longer even be human. Well, now that's a thought. That brings up a lot of psychological questions and philosophical questions. What does it even mean to be a person? What does the Christian mindset or worldview have anything to say about that? Well, it certainly does. But what do they mean? Well, if you believe in evolution, if you believe that you are the culmination of billions of years of evolution from a worm or a bacteria, then why wouldn't you want to bring the next step of evolution? Because you would certainly think that we're better off than a worm or a bacteria, and that's true. But why stop here? Why wouldn't you use technology and DNA coding to force the next big leap in evolution? Why wouldn't you do that? That's the way they think. And so there's these ideas of being transhuman, which is somewhat combined with machines to the point that you can basically download programs and run them in your brain. And I'm speaking on a very lay level here. I know that if you're studied up on this more than I am, you can probably say you didn't say that right, and that's fine. I probably didn't say that right. And then there's people that believe in being, you know, post-human, which means to be something beyond human on the evolutionary spectrum. Well, what is possible even? Well, I've found this to be fascinating. John says that the world was created by the Word, right? In the beginning was the Word. Words convey information. And the deeper scientists dig into DNA, what word do they use to talk about DNA? They use the word information. I find that really, really compelling to think about the fact that there are words in our DNA. So if you can learn that language and convert that to zeros and ones, then the idea is that you can turn biology into a computer code that can be downloaded and uploaded, and your consciousness could be passed on forever. You could live forever that way. I don't know if that sounds bizarre to you or not. It does a little bit to me. It sounds like, how did that even work? Like, if I really could put my consciousness on a USB stick, could I put it in Keith then? Like, who would he be at that point? That's weird. But I think that we're probably years and years away from that particular scenario playing out. And I suppose it could be argued that God will somehow intervene like he did at the Tower of Babel, and so we don't need to worry about it at all. Well, there's no guarantee that God's going to do that. He may just let man self-destruct. He may not come down and confuse them like he did. So I don't think I would count on that. I think it would be better if we would think thoughtfully about questions like, what is human being? What is that? What are we going to stake our lives on? What are we going to claim as the foundation of our faith, and so on? I'm going to submit to you this morning that I think we are more susceptible to this part of earth worship than perhaps the crazies that hug the trees. Forgive me for using words like that. I'm just trying to be provocative. And the reason I think that we're more susceptible to being willing to download our consciousness to a USB drive is because we act as if we believe that it's a good thing to reduce the negative effects of the curse. I don't live among people who spend a lot of time talking about how to get in cycle with the moon's phases so that you know exactly when to plant. Those aren't the people that I tend to spend a lot of time with. I spend more time with people who are trying really, really hard to figure out the best way to get rid of every ache and pain. And so we're susceptible to the latest chiropractic technique and the latest, what was the thing there for a while? Plexus or whatever it was. Like the thing that's going to fix our problems. And so that's one reason I think we're more susceptible to this deception. And the other reason I think we are is because we've kind of already bought into some of it. And we believe that we are responsible to rule in the world and subdue it. So what does that mean? And what are the things that we're talking about? Well, I gave you a list of acronyms earlier, and I want to just define some of them right now. But you've heard of GMOs, I'm sure. What is a GMO? It's a genetically modified organism. Probably the most popular one that all of us here are familiar with are Roundup Ready plants, in which the genetic code has been manipulated so that glyphosate chemicals do not kill those plants. And that has been arguably quite an advance in technology. Now, there's people that don't think you should use them, but again, the people that I tend to spend time with will readily defend the use of GMO seeds. Why not? Those organic fields are ugly anyway. You can't grow near as much corn to the acre if you just cultivate it the old way with non-GMO corn, so why not? There's a fish that has been genetically modified called the Aqua Advantage salmon. It grows like twice as fast as the regular salmon. And so I don't know if y'all are big salmon eaters. If you are, you might have already eaten an Aqua Advantage salmon. My point is, we've already kind of accepted GMOs. That's just life. I don't know if you can get away from eating completely unmodified food, perhaps, but it would be quite intentional, I would think. We also talked a little bit about an acronym, mRNA. This is big words, messenger ribonucleic acid. It's a type of RNA that carries genetic instructions, and there might be a little bit of confusion about this. The most popular mRNA that we would know about is the latest COVID vaccines. And there's big questions about whether that should be used because it does mess around with your DNA a little bit. Well, how it works from my basic understanding is that it doesn't actually modify your DNA as such, but the RNA is an acid that tricks your body into producing the spike-like cells that look like COVID so that it learns to fight that particular shape. That's kind of my vague understanding of that. And so it doesn't turn you into a person that their eyes glow in the dark or anything like that, but it does do something different than the traditional dead vaccine or weak vaccine where the actual virus or whatever's in your body and your body builds an immune to that. What about human DNA editing? If you can take the genetic code of a plant and make it so that it doesn't die when you spray glyphosate on it. What can be done with humans? Well, in 2018, a Chinese doctor secretly used the CRISPR technology. CRISPR is a big acronym that just is the technology used to edit DNA code. And he created some HIV-resistant babies. Well, that seems like a good thing. Like, why wouldn't you want to be HIV-resistant? Well, the Chinese government, I guess it was the Chinese government, some other people anyway, disagreed with him, and he is in jail because his editing of the human DNA in that particular case actually edited the germline, meaning that this trait would be passed on as a DNA edit. It's a permanent edit. So if these HIV-resistant babies would grow up and have babies, their babies would also carry that DNA modification. Well, that does seem a little scary. Like, what if you don't want that after all? Can you splice that back in? Well, we don't know the answers to some of those. I don't know the answers to those questions. But if you take the worldview that humans are just another piece of the puzzle on the evolutionary chain, the question becomes, why not? Right? Like, what logic would you use if you really believe that you're just a product of billions of years of evolution? It's no different than a corn plant. You're just a little more sophisticated. And I do believe that we might be a little more susceptible to that particular line of thinking. And so I understand that it's technically possible to edit human genetics for intelligence, strength, eye color, and other traits in unborn children. Now, there's lots of concerns around that, even in the atheistic evolutionary scientific field, and it's because of things like, well, what about unintended consequences? Well, what about them? If you start deciding that you want everybody to be a certain physical strength or eye color or something like that, then you're skirting the fields of eugenics. What about all that inequality? And what about the basic human dignity? There's big questions about those things. There are other types of genetic engineering that are perhaps less controversial. They can be used to treat sickle cell diseases, leukemia, and so on. And one of the reasons this isn't nearly as controversial is because it does not edit the germline. In other words, if you get this treatment, it will not be passed on to the next generation. And so it seems to mitigate some of those huge concerns. Vaccines by themselves are perhaps controversial, but the mRNA seem to be more controversial because of the trick that it plays on the human DNA. One of the other technologies that the committee gave me to think about was the Neuralink, and I hadn't spent much time thinking about Neuralink, and I still don't, honestly. I did a little digging into it to figure out what exactly it is, and I still don't know if I totally understand it, but my understanding is that this Neuralink is a company that's started by Elon Musk, and I don't know what y'all think about Elon Musk up here in Pennsylvania, but there's varying opinions of that particular individual where I come from. And he started this company, and they designed devices that are to read from and write to brain activity by implanting thin wires with electrodes into the brain. And from what I understand, these wires are so thin and so delicate that humans cannot put them in the brain. It has to be done robotically. They're just too tiny. And so the device is supposed to enable, and it does actually work. They've done a few human tests on it. One man actually lives in Loosedale, Mississippi, which I find quite interesting. Loosedale is just 2 hours away from us. I might go visit the man. I don't know. We'll see. But anyway, so the device is to give direct communication between the brain and external technologies. So the way this would work with a smartphone, for instance, when you take your smartphone and you want to, say, navigate to a particular address, how many actions do you perform to get that accomplished? Well, you have to pick up the phone. You open the phone, however you do that, either by sliding on your keypad or Face ID or however, somehow you get the phone to open. You select the app. You type in the address. Well, the idea is that every one of those actions triggers a particular brain pattern. And so if you can just think that that's what you're going to do, your phone does all of those things automatically. It is working with these men that have had these things implanted. One of them's in Arizona, I believe, and the other one's there in Mississippi, the ones that I've looked at. One has ALS, the other one was hurt in a motorcycle accident, and he's paralyzed from his neck down. And they can control, the man there in Loosedale, he can actually play the game Call of Duty on his computer just with thought. That's amazing. I don't know about y'all, but I'm not good at playing computer games. I'm not that coordinated. So the idea of being able to do it with your brain might actually turn me into an addict if I tried it. I don't know. But I'm not planning to try it. And so the medical application is one of them for the Neuralink, one reason. And so it seems really difficult to say that it's bad to help paralyzed people retain some functions with their minds. That seems kind of I'm not sure how you would argue that that's bad. But Musk's long-term vision for the Neuralink is to enable human AI integration to enhance cognition and to also avoid being outpaced by artificial intelligence. So what that means is people that are creating artificial intelligence models believe, some of them, that eventually AI will get out of hand and somehow control us. I've not studied this enough. I honestly don't know. I probably should care, but it's not one of those things that rises to the top of my concerns when I'm lying in bed at night. So I just say that to say that part of me wants to just smile a little bit whenever I hear people saying, oh, you know, we're going to be controlled by a bunch of crazy robots someday. Hey, maybe in 10 years you'll say you really should have listened. But Elon Musk thinks that that might be the case. And so his idea is that if we can somehow get man and machine integrated well enough, then we can stay ahead of AI. Like we can keep the demon chained. I don't know what y'all think of that. It'd be an interesting lunch discussion. But that's one of his long-term visions. I just think that in spite of the help that some of these people are getting with Neuralink technology, we might need to remember that that is also part of what's involved in that. What about virtual reality, things like that? Well, what is virtual reality? I've never messed with virtual reality setups at all. But my understanding is that it's a computer-generated world in which you can interact with a fully developed computer world with a headset and sensors, and you're immersed in the digital world. And it's used a lot for job training. It's also used to simulate military or medical operations, and also, of course, video gaming. And there's probably other nefarious purposes for virtual reality. And again, when I read some of the documentation on this, well, if you're in the military and you're planning an operation, it kind of makes sense to set up a 3D world in which your men can walk through and familiarize themselves with it. Because if you die in virtual reality, well, that's just dying in virtual reality. Why? It seems like it might not, like the intuition seems good. But I don't know that I would want to say without some serious thinking that this is something that we should consider for answers for any given scenario that anybody can think of. Because it seems to me that humans have proven that we're not very good at just blanket acceptance of modern technology. It seems like it hasn't helped us become that much better as a species. We didn't talk much about artificial intelligence, but that's another technological advance that's taking a lot of attention right now. And I did read an article about a man who got involved in a conversation with the popular chat GPT. Y'all have probably heard of that. Perhaps you even use it. And so he was asking questions, and ChatGPT was giving him answers. And somehow along the way, they went down the trail of him asking questions about his own deity, and ChatGPT affirmed that he was indeed some sort of deity and that he was somehow the savior of the world. His father tried desperately to tell him that this is just an echo chamber. This is just computer doing something somewhat random, perhaps. Maybe not as random as it seems, but it's playing off whatever you give it, right? That's how AI works. Well, he got some help, but he's still convinced, this particular man in the article, is still convinced that he is communicating with a sentient AI. Weird, but true. What is a thoughtful Christian response to all of this? If it's okay to put pacemakers for heart issues, if it's okay to put deep brain stimulation for Parkinson's patients, why wouldn't you use Neuralink? What's the big deal about genetic engineering of humans when we clearly have no qualms about growing and consuming GMO soybeans and corn? Why is it scary now? Why wasn't it scary then? Well, it's scary because it's obvious and becoming more obvious that the more we advance in technology as a society, the less we sense a need for prayer and divine help. And one thing that still gets people's attention, and it's so interesting to me that it does, sort of, is natural disasters. Natural disasters, we just lived through a tornado there this spring. And it's so fascinating how people start to talk when they recognize the power in a windstorm. It's fascinating. However, I don't know how to describe to you the hollow feeling in my stomach when I was in a conversation with some people about the floods in Texas. Did you know that they created that flood by seeding clouds? I will not ask you to raise your hand if you believe that. I don't even know if I care if you believe that. But why would we look... I don't even know how to say what I'm thinking, but why would we actually give man credit for doing something like that? Because if they did it, then why didn't they stop it? Why? I don't know. There's so many questions. Just so many questions about that. But it seems that we pretty much think as a society that we can fix anything. We can find the answer. We can fix it with enough time and enough money and enough technology. And I am not convinced that this is just an atheistic mindset. I think it's the water we swim in, and it certainly has affected us as well. So how shall we live? What are some principles to guide us in this? Well, I'm just going to very quickly again wrap up with some principles from the Word of God, and I don't know that we'll turn to every one of them. You can write the references down if you wish. Number one, to help us navigate modern technology and the advances of that field, always remember, as God's people, always remember, God is the Lord, there is none other. Neither the earth is God, nor is man God. Period. Isaiah 45:18 makes that very clear. Secondly, there is no salvation but through Jesus Christ. Peter tells us that in Acts 4, verses 8 through 12. There is no name by which men can be saved. And so one of the things that I think we need to remember when we think about neo-paganism is my definition of idolatry is that which people look to for answers. If we're looking to life's solutions, if we're looking to life's answers to technology, we are forgetting that Jesus is the only way that we can truly experience redemption and salvation. Third thing, men who worship nature and refuse to recognize God will be given over to a reprobate state. Romans 1:28 makes that very clear. When we refuse to recognize God as the Creator, there are no limits to the degradation of the human state. Fourth, humans are not machines to be coded and manipulated. They are the images of God, specially made with the breath of God. And I don't know what all that means, but Genesis 1:27 is very clear. I do not believe that we are to be coded and decoded with computers. I just don't believe that. Fifth thing, God is pleased when men seek him. Hebrews 12 makes that clear. Any endeavors to find answers without considering God's plan for a life of faith is idolatry. Sixth, God seeks those who worship in spirit and in truth. John 4, verses 23 to 24. And the reason I bring this up is because one of the concerns that I have about virtual reality is that it isn't a reality. And God does not redeem fake people. There is no redemption for a false person. And so if we are building a world of virtual reality, and that's who we are, there is no seeking God in spirit and in truth. Seventh, he who seeks to save his life will lose it, Matthew 16:25. And right along with that, Matthew 16:24, what is a man profited if he gains the whole world and loses his soul? There's an invaluable component to man that I don't think can be downloaded to a USB drive. And if you gain everything and lose that, Jesus asks the question, what is that profit? I think I'm ready for number nine. Sometimes, stick with me through this point. Sometimes it is through infirmity and sickness that God is glorified. Think of John chapter 9. Who did sin, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Jesus said, neither. It is because the glory of God is about to be revealed in this man. Paul says, when I am weak, then I am strong. He also says that we have a treasure in earthen vessels. So the attempt to make a transhuman or a post-human doesn't seem to fit with the biblical model that it is somehow through infirmity and sickness that God becomes bigger than he would otherwise. I have my points lettered and not numbered, so I don't remember what number I'm ready for, but it's letter J. I think it's number 10. God's moral boundary is crossed when men exploit the weak and downtrodden. Any scientific or any human endeavor that gives the advantage to the strong at the expense of the weak is categorically wrong and will be judged. Matthew chapter 25, verses 34 to 39. And last, remember that while all things might be lawful, all things are not helpful or expedient. 1 Corinthians 6:12 and 10:23. And that last point, I feel like I need to just flesh out just a tiny little bit. I don't actually believe that Paul was saying that every single thing is actually okay for him to do. I don't think that's what he was saying. I think he was quoting one of the Corinthians proverbs to them, and then he was giving the Christian answer saying, that's not true. That there are some things that Christians simply do not do because they will not reach the goal of what Christianity is all about. In conclusion, I am positive that I didn't give enough detail to these questions, and maybe I didn't even give enough of a summary, but I do hope that at least going through some of these principles, we have strengthened our commitment to Jesus Christ, to the truth of the Scriptures, and to our commitment to brothers and sisters in Christ. God bless you.